February 7th, come see punk legends DOA at the Rickshaw. It's the release party for DOA's new live album, Welcome to Chinatown. It's going to be a wild night as DOA welcomes special guests, the Ford Pier Vengeance Trio, Aging Youth Gang, the return of Mr. Plow, and introducing Jenny from Calgary. See Canada's top punk band DOA Friday, February 7th at the Rickshaw. Tickets at Zulu, Red Cat, Scrape, High Life, Neptune, and Northern Tickets. For more info, go to www.suddendeath.com.
Hi, this is Audie from Broken Bones, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And all I'm going to say to you is, fuck off and go. Ah!
For a taste of the classics with a twist, join me, Marguerite, with Classical Chaos, Sunday mornings starting at 9, right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday the 7th of February. I'm Konstantin Perdanovich.
I'm Jasmine Gaddy.
And I'm Christine Kim. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:05 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Today's top stories and segments are newly elected AMS President Tanner Boker here to speak with Morgan Yee about his campaign, his success, and how he intends to live up to his platform.
As well as segment two, Konstantin Perdanovich's discussion with representatives from the Women's Center regarding a recent open letter to UBC President Stephen Toop about the graphic annual displays by UBC's pro-life group on International Women's Day.
We also have today's hot topic. In today's episode, Christine Kim asks students about their views on the recent exploding toothpaste warnings put out by the Americans as the Sochi Olympics take off. And we also have a piece by contributor Morme Zink, who discusses the recent passing of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Later in the program, we have Nina Krizhia interview with UBC professor Chris Erickson on the recent AMS election and the use of joke candidates. How does this affect perceptions of student politics and democracy as a whole? But first, we go to Morgan Yee and Tanner Boker.
Hi, Tanner. Thanks for being with us here today on News 101.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on your recent presidency.
Thank you.
So I guess my first question for you would be, when do you take over from Carolyn Wong?
So I officially take over and the rest of my team on March 1st. So right now we're in the middle of our transition process where both executives are working together, learning the ropes, and we're looking forward to a good start and hitting the ground running in March.
Now, how has that relationship been? Because I know you weren't actually running against Carolyn. So how do you think that's affected the way you guys are working together right now?
I would say the race didn't really have much of an impact. I mean, she understands as we're kind of swapping out that there's a lot that I need to learn as well. So it's been a great working relationship. I've worked with her, obviously, when she was president and I was VP external this year. So it's a pretty smooth transition, and she's been extremely helpful to me.
Excellent. So the next question, what do you think made your campaign so successful? I know we were chatting about it a bit before the interview.
I think for me, I had a bit of a different campaign than most candidates. Mine, I had to balance between work and school. I still work, but 95 hours for the society per week. So I couldn't be on the ground the entire time. I relied a lot upon my volunteers, talking to different groups. For myself, I focused a lot on different constituencies like the International Student Association, Mental Health Network, and a lot of just in-person meetings that way. And then I relied a lot on my website. I tried to use different technology than candidates do. Candidates usually do, use the Platform Coordination Builder. And then the rest was through the debates. I mean, I really think it's a lot about one-on-one conversations, but also trying to get your message out there and showing your professionalism and showing how much you care about the position and the society.
Right. So can you tell me, you did allude to it earlier, about some of your past experiences with student politics, and do you think that you brought any of those, you were able to bring some of those experiences into this campaign?
Yeah, so for me, I started as the Associate VP External in 2012. I worked under previous VP External Kyle Warwick, and then I founded a group called Get On Board BC, which was talking about transit funding, basically Metro Vancouver. I ran uncontested for VP External, so I've served for 1 year, which was a bit of a different race running against yourself. And then this year, I had an incredible experience. I was able to found a group called the Alliance of BC Students, which is BC's largest post-secondary lobbying organization. So I've been taking all of my experiences from all those positions and applying it towards the presidency. Even when I was VP External, though, I was working a lot on the internal issues of the society, so I'm very familiar with how it works and where improvements need to be made.
Right. So when you were planning your campaign platform, how much of that is coming from your own experiences of what students need being a student yourself?
I would say more than 60% of that is from my own personal experiences, just being a student in general.
Yeah.
The rest is a lot from other students that I spoke with. But leading up to the campaigns, you have conversations with different on-campus groups about what they'd like to see. And I probably spend a good 2 to 3 months talking with different groups. Not so much just pre-campaigning, but more so just asking, what can we do at UBC to make this campus more active? And I got a lot of great feedback, incorporated that in into my platform, and then eventually that's what I ran on.
Right. So now, having been the VP external and understanding, you know, what goes on, how much of that is impacting your campaign platform? Like, when you know sort of what's possible to do and what's needed from that perspective?
It provides context. I mean, you understand the AMS when you're an executive and when you've served for a year, so you get some of the internal aspects, even if you're not, you know, totally involved in it. It's actually a bit of a challenge, though, for me, because my portfolio as the VP External is always the most removed from students. So I'm dealing with government. I'm dealing with the UPass program. I'm not always dealing with clubs. I'm not dealing with constituency. So it's going to be a challenge for me moving forward to actually separate my experience as VP External and being the president representing the entire society. It's a lot of learning for me to understand how other portfolios that I haven't necessarily been involved with that much actually work.
Yeah. And so I know that in the past you ran on a platform that was really transit heavy. So can you tell us more about what you ran on this time around?
So this year was focused around transition. This is a very exciting year for the AMS. We're moving into the new sub in November 2014. We are having a new UBC president come on board in June or July. So a lot of it is just focusing on getting the society ready for the new building, but also building a new relationship with the university, their administration, and also with government. There's a lot of work that we have to do there, a lot of challenges that are about to come down, and some that may not necessarily be in the best interest of students. So my goal this year is really to create a healthier student society and leave it better for students going forward.
Okay. And just on a side note, with the new UBC president coming in, how much say does the AMS Society have in that?
So there's something called the Presidential Search Committee, of which the AMS does have a representative.
Okay.
Those meetings are confidential, so I'm not even involved in them. I don't know what's going on. It's going to be as much of a shock to a lot of us internally as the rest of the students, but we do have one rep.
Okay.
And then the Graduate Student Society also has one rep on there as
okay.
well.
Do you know how many other reps there are? Like, it's two students out of...
It's two students, and I actually think that's it.
Okay.
The rest is board members, faculty members, and staff.
Okay. How many other members are there on the board?
I believe it's a committee of about 15.
Okay. So back to your platform. You're looking to create sustainable change, and how do you plan to uphold this platform as we're moving into the new year?
So I was really careful when I developed my platform and when I was looking at the year to not take on too much, and I think that's sometimes a challenge when you're running for president. You just want to take on everything, and you think you have so much time, but a year is a very short amount of time in the AMS to get anything done. So a lot of the goals that I focused on were measurable, were easy. I'm not going to say easy, but they're things that you can put in motion in 1 year.
Yeah.
So for me, it's a lot of creating tangible and solid timelines and sticking to it.
Okay.
And keeping myself accountable and keeping my team accountable to those goals.
Do you have like one specific goal that you can give us that you think is definitely achievable?
Something that I really want to do is create a student assembly. It's to bring groups like the Residence Hall Association, the Frats, Athletics, all of them back into the AMS decisional structure.
Okay.
It's not an easy thing to do,
yep.
but it's absolutely achievable in the next 12 months.
Excellent. We will speak to you sometime in the next 12 months and great. Check in on that, definitely. So... going into the more personal, looking into the future, where do you see your student political career going?
So for me, this is my last year in the AMS. I've been with it now for 3 years, which, well, by the time I'll be leaving, it'll be 3 years. It's been a great journey for me, but I think I need to go back and focus on my academics, which have been a bit on the wayside for the past couple of years, and then focus on my degree and moving forward from there.
Okay, so in 5 years from now, where do you see yourself?
In 5 years, so I'm an international student, and I'm an American. I'll probably end up heading back to the States, working in music educational policy, which is where I wanted to get started.
Wow, and what does that entail?
So public education programs in the States, they're facing a lot of cutbacks, and something that I used to do in high school was get involved with groups that were trying to restore funding or bring music programs to inner city schools. So that's basically what I'm looking to get involved with, to ensure that there are strong music programs in public systems across the country.
Okay. Tell us something that the public may not know about President Tanner Boker.
May not know. So I'm a bit of a band nerd to an extent, and it's something that I think the U of C featured as well. I've been playing sax for 13 years, but I was also in a marching band. I played jazz band. Music is pretty much my life, and it's still something I'm going to plan on doing.
Nice.
So hopefully I'll be able to, still as president, go out, play a couple gigs.
Well, so CIT, I will have to get you in here and play live sometime.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun.
And finally, last question. Later in the show, we have an interview with Professor Chris Erickson. Discussing the use of joke candidates in the election. They were featured pretty heavily this year. So we were wondering what you think about the use of joke candidates in student politics.
It really depends on the joke candidates. I would say this year something very interesting happened, which is you had one joke candidate in the presidential race who actually brought up fantastic points. They weren't just running a joke campaign for the sake of running a joke campaign. They actually talked about issues that students faced and did raise some very valid points. I think in the case of the VP externals race, where you had Jon Snow, that was definitely just creativity and humor there, which brought more attention to the races as a whole. There is a bit of a numerical impact on it as well. Like, vote splitting is something that happens even with our Condorcet voting system, which is complicated to say the least. It does actually have an impact on votes. So there's certainly an impact on the student involvement, getting them more involved, but also mm-hmm. on who actually is going to win those elections.
Right. And do you think it affects students' views of democracy? Like, when you introduce, a joke aspect to democracy?
I think there are some students that are going to say, this is making a mockery of the process, which I think those views are totally valid. But also, in a student election, it does bring a little bit of brevity where sometimes it's needed.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Tanner.
Thanks.
Yes, thanks for your time. We're going to take a quick PSA break. And we'll be right back with your headlines.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to the Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
And now your headlines for today. In campus news, UBC is asking for student involvement in the tuition process. UBC has released an open tuition proposal, which it hopes will boost student awareness and participation in the current tuition process. The proposal comes after a trend of operating expense increases paired with decreasing provincial subsidies for the university. The university is asking students to get involved in creating a future-focused framework to successfully balance the university's budget. Students can submit comments and thoughts regarding the issues at students.ubc.ca/tuition-proposal.
The UBC AMS elections have now concluded. Minutes following our broadcast last Friday, the AMS election results were announced live at the Gallery Lounge and Bar. For the position of AMS president, Tanner Boger beat out Harsev Oshan by a margin of just 29 votes. Matus Miodolowski defeated incumbent Joaquim Avecvido for VP Finance. Anne Kassir kept her position as VP Academic, beating Mona Maleki 2,989 votes to 2,784 votes. For VP Administration, Ava Naziri beat Serena Nig. And finally, Chris Roach and Nina Karimi won the two student positions on the UBC Board of Governors. A total of 10,689 students voted in the elections, a voter turnout of 22.4%. This is an unfortunate return to typical voter turnout, down 21.5% from last year's referendum on the UPass.
In national news, Prime Minister Harper has announced the First Nations education funding overhaul. Earlier today, Harper announced changes to the First Nations Education Act that would take effect in 2015, including $500 million for a new infrastructure on reserves. The new legislation also promises to give First Nations communities more control over their education systems. In making the announcement, Harper was joined by Aboriginal Affairs Minister Bernard Valcourt, Assembly of First Nations National Chair Chief Sean Atlio, and regional chiefs from all across the country. In regards to the new legislation, Aboriginal Affairs Minister Valcourt said, quote, "The Government of Canada agrees that the First Nations must have control over their education. The proposal that I put forth is intended to empower those who know best what their children need, First Nations parents, communities, and administrators, to determine what is most effective for their success. The federal government wants the act to be in place in time for the next school year in September."
Keystone Pipeline's final impact statement has been released. Earlier this week, the U.S. State Department released a final supplemental environmental impact statement regarding the proposed Keystone Pipeline, which would run from central Canada down into Nebraska. The review suggested that the pipeline would have little actual impact on the greenhouse gases coming from the oil sands. President Barack Obama has vowed to approve the cross-border pipeline only if it does not add to business-as-usual carbon emissions. This suggestion that the project would have little impact on current gas emissions removes a key hurdle for the final approval of the project. It will now go through a 90-day review process, after which President Obama must decide whether or not to approve the project.
Those are your UBC campus, local, and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Studying abroad looks great on your resume and opens doors for exciting career paths. Don't miss the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Wednesday, February 26th from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Convention Center, East Ballroom. Admission is free. Come early at 2 p.m. to listen to our guest seminar on how to access over $100 million worth of scholarships for your studies. Check the website on studyandgoabroad.com.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CIDR.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Next up on today's program, we have today's episode of Hot Topic. In today's episode, Christine Kim asks students about their views on the recent exploding toothpaste warnings put out by the Americans as the Sochi Olympics take off.
Welcome to this week's Hot Topic. The topic this week is about a recent report by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security that warned all airlines flying into Russia to beware explosives hidden in toothpaste tubes. The Department of Homeland Security said that it was not aware of any, quote, specific threat, but nonetheless made the statement anyways. I asked students about whether or not they thought this statement was over the top or simply a precautionary measure. Take a listen. Great. So can I just have your name first?
Sophia.
Okay. And what faculty and what year are you in?
Science, year two.
Okay. Recently, America has come out with a report to all airlines asking to beware of explosive toothpaste going into Russia, all of the airlines flying into Russia. Do you think that this is over the top, or do you think that it's a precautionary measure?
If there is concern about it, I think it's, you know, good to be cautious about it. You know, if there's, like, a concern about it, there's nothing wrong with being overly, just being preventative, I think, is a good thing.
Okay. So what's your name?
Aruba.
Okay. And what faculty and what year are you in?
I'm in fourth year studying international relations.
All right. So recently, America has come out with a report to all airlines flying into Russia to beware of explosive toothpaste. Do you think that this is an over-the-top statement to make, or do you think that it's a precautionary measure?
Explosive toothpaste. That's interesting. I think I would definitely just be interested in it would be stopped in terms of carrying explosive toothpaste, because I mean, if we just take a look at the recent example of that Edmonton boy who boarded a plane to Mexico with a bomb in his luggage, and was only pardoned, I think, with, like, $100 and, like, a year of probation or something like that. So I just think it's interesting how these things are framed and who affects the most in terms of the racialization of, you know, of these, like, so-called terrorist measures and the securitization of our, you know, airports has definitely been through a bias lens, I think, and specifically, like, explosive toothpaste, it just seems another securitization method that is just really intriguing to me. to be honest, right now I just can't figure out why specifically it's one specific item that they're targeting. And yeah, not explosives in general. It just seems a little erratic.
So first, just give me your name.
Ruby.
And what faculty and what year are you in?
I'm in third year sociology.
So, recently, the Department of Homeland Security in America has sent out a report to all airlines flying into Russia asking to beware of explosive toothpaste. Do you think that this is an over-the-top statement to make, or do you think that this is a precautionary measure?
I think it's a good precautionary measure to take, just so people are aware of what's going on. I don't think it's over the top. Just something to watch out for, especially with something that has happened in China with the baby formula a while back. So I think it's a good thing to be aware of the chemicals that you're putting into your body. And yeah.
Do you think that there's a greater need for security measures since the Winter Olympics are in Russia this year?
Yes, I think there should be greater security measures. I think it's good.
Alan Takayasu.
Okay, and what faculty and what year are you in?
Science, first year.
Okay. So recently, the Department of Homeland Security has come out with a report asking all airlines going into Russia to beware of explosive toothpaste. Do you think that this is an overtop statement to make, or do you think it's a precautionary measure?
I'd say precautionary. They've had problems with liquid explosives before, so, I mean, precaution. I mean, it's just kind of a small inconvenience that I feel like wouldn't impede too much.
Do you think that there's a greater need for security measures like this since the Winter Olympics are in Russia this year?
I wouldn't say specifically because it's Russia, but perhaps a greater need still because, I mean, it's the Olympics. They've had problems with that before. But there was their adoptions, and it was when Steve Prefontaine was racing. I believe it was in, but maybe Eastern Germany when it was still closed off.
So please just first give me your name.
Francesca Giolini.
Okay, and what faculty and what year are you in?
I'm in arts, I'm studying psychology, and I'm in year two.
Okay, so recently, the Department of Homeland Security in America has sent out a message to all airlines asking for the airplanes flying into Russia to beware of explosive toothpaste. Do you think that this is an overtop statement to make, or do you think it's just a precautionary measure?
I guess it makes sense, you know, if you're worried about explosives, you're worried about explosives. It's, I'm not very aware of any kind of political statement, so I'm not very opinionated on these topics.
So first, just give me your name.
Taryn.
And what faculty and what year are you in?
I'm in second year science.
Great. So recently, there's been a report by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security asking all airlines flying into Russia to beware of explosive toothpaste. Do you think that this is an overtop statement to make, or do you think that this is just a precautionary measure?
I'm not sure. I guess I'd have to know more to make a decision on whether I thought that was valid or not. Well, I don't think you can really be wary of other passengers having toothpaste, because if it's within the allowed amount, then people can legally take it on.
Do you think that there's any reason that, I guess, the general public should be a little bit more worried about security in Russia right now?
Maybe. And a lot of people are angry about certain things that are happening in Russia around the Olympics, and there's been attacks at Olympics previously. So, like, I think it's always a concern for some people, but...
So, what's your name?
Edwin.
Okay, and what faculty and what year are you in?
Land and Food Systems. I'm in my second year.
Okay, that's awesome. So recently there's been a news report by the Department of Homeland Security asking all airlines flying into Russia to beware of explosive toothpaste. Do you think that this is an overtop statement to make, or do you think it's just a precautionary measure?
I don't think the TSA is super effective at their jobs.
Okay.
Like, if someone really wanted to get an explosive onto an airplane, they could. There's lots of ways to circumvent the system. So I think specifically targeting toothpaste might just... force people to resort to more creative methods.
Okay. Do you think that there's any reason why the general public should be a little bit more concerned about security, especially since the Winter Olympics are in Russia?
Honestly, an event that draws thousands of people and spectators is always going to draw bad attention, especially from those who aim to, like, make a point or to hurt others to further their point. So while increased security is a necessary... necessary to protect the safety of the spectators, I don't feel like that forcing that upon every the global environment of transportation will aid in solving these problems. These are more like ideological issues that you need to solve rather than safety issues.
So first, what's your name?
Mara.
And what faculty and what year are you in?
I'm in fourth year and I'm in our Faculty of Arts.
Okay. Recently, there's been a report by the U.S. Department of Homeland and Security asking all airlines flying into Russia to beware of explosive toothpaste. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is a over-the-top statement to make or just a precautionary measure?
It's like a bit of over the top because the U.S. does have a lot of like precautionary measures over everything. However, though there has been, I'm not sure. There's a lot of terrorist like threats all over, and a lot of people saying they're not even bringing their family members as Olympians into the Olympics. So maybe it's precautionary, but like a bit too much. But also there are threats. I'm not sure, however, the sources of these like threats and stuff. So I haven't looked up on it myself, so I can't really say an informed decision.
Just in your opinion, do you think the general public has a little bit more to be worried about since the Winter Olympics are in Russia this year, or not?
Particularly like beforehand, before hearing all these threats on like on Russia, I wouldn't have thought there should be any reason to worry just because it's Russia itself. Yeah, I wasn't worried beforehand. I don't have I'm from Eastern Europe. I wouldn't be that worried. However, like because of all the threats on the media, maybe it's getting a bit like a snowball effect.
So what's your name?
Tanner.
And what's your faculty and your year of study?
I'm third year in physics.
Okay. So recently there's been a report by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security asking all airlines flying into Russia to beware of explosive toothpaste. Do you think that this is an overtop statement, or do you think that this is just a precautionary measure, just on first glance?
I'd say it seems a little overcautious, but I don't know.
From what you've heard about the Winter Olympics, do you think that there's more need to have all these security measures?
Well, safety has to come first with our athletes. If we're sending them over there, they have to be safe.
Have you heard more about security measures regarding the Winter Olympics this year than previous years?
Yes, a lot more.
Thanks for listening. That was a hot topic. Please tune in next time.
Thank you for that, Christine.
And now we go to Kosef for his report on the GAP project.
A Canada-wide initiative run by the Center for Bioethical Reform, the Genocide Awareness Project, or GAP, puts on pro-life displays in public locations all over the country every year. The group commonly displays graphic images of abortions next to images of genocide in order to attempt to draw parallels between the two issues. These displays have stirred up controversy at university campuses all over the country. The University of British Columbia is no exception. The GAP holds annual protests in high-traffic areas on campus. They are often met with mass opposition from student social justice initiatives who physically counter their protests. This year, the AMS Women's Center at UBC has released an open letter to University President Stephen Toop, asking him to take initiative in banning the graphic visual imagery displayed by the GAP. The Women's Center stated, quote, "The AMS Women's Center respects all opinions regarding abortion and takes no specific stance in the life versus choice debate. However, it cannot accept the university's allowance of GAP displays given their potential to harm our peers. Our student body is clearly disturbed by the GAP signs. I spoke with Jane Shee, a coordinator at the AMS Women's Center, about the GAP protest and her perspective on the issue." I'm with Jane Shee of the Women's Center here at UBC. How are you, Jane?
I'm good.
Could you possibly explain what exactly the Genocide Awareness Project is and speak a little to their platform?
Well, the Genocide Awareness Project is a large display that is a part of the Center for Bioethical Reform. And every year they come to campuses across Canada, the U.S., and they display extremely large magnified images comparing genocide to abortion as a way of sort of promoting their pro-life, anti-abortion beliefs.
Could you speak a little to the history of the Genocide Awareness Project's presence here at the UBC campus?
Well, I've only been here for a few years, but from what I know, they've come here for many years, and every year students would protest it. And when I was in second year, about 2 years ago, a woman protested the signs naked as a way of sort of saying you know, this is a woman's body. She eventually got academic misconduct and was told to dress up, basically put on some clothes, as a sort of way of, like for her, it was, you know, like, if this is a woman's body, like, it can't possibly be more explicit than their signs, which compare abortion to genocide.
Right. And so, obviously, that's a very fine example of what students are doing to combat the Genocide Awareness Project here on campus. But is there anything that works for this year in particular that you've heard of?
Well, we've just... at the Women's Center, we've collectively written a letter. The coordinators here collectively written a letter to President Stephen Toop, asking him specifically to ban the signs. We're not asking to ban the actual Center for Bioethical Reform of coming to campus, but we are asking specifically to have the signs, the graphic imagery, removed from campus, because they're very triggering for women and just anyone else who's sort of like basically anyone who's been affected either by abortion or genocide would be extremely affected by this issue.
Is there any responses from either students or faculty that you've gotten over the letter?
So far, it's only been student response. So far, it's been people who have been consistently protesting the signs before, and it's just been them applauding the letter and saying that it's good on us that we sent it. And we have not heard a response from Toop.
Have you heard it all from the Genocide Awareness Project?
Nope.
Well, thank you very much for being here today. I appreciate it.
That was Jane Shi from the Women's Center here at UBC, speaking out against the Genocide Awareness Project.
Thank you, Costa, for that piece. Our next segment is by contributor Mormay Zank, who discusses the recent passing of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Hello, my name is Mormay Zanke, and tonight I'm going to be talking a little bit about Philip Seymour Hoffman's death and its portrayal in the media. So for those of you who haven't heard, Philip Seymour Hoffman died early Sunday morning due to an apparent heroin overdose. Philip Seymour Hoffman was a famous actor. He starred in blockbusters like The Twister, Charlie Wilson's War, and recently he took on a main role in The Hunger Games. He was found with a syringe in his arm. There were close to 50 envelopes of heroin in his apartment and 20 used syringes. So it's evident that his death was related to a drug-induced reaction. This is a little bit of a deja vu. Thinking back to Corey Monteith's death earlier on in the year, Heath Ledger's death, these stories seem to keep cropping up. Male celebrity found in apartment, kind of in a reclusive setting. We aren't entirely sure what the circumstances are. It's all shrouded in a kind of pit of mystery. It's troubling, and I think that the way they're portrayed in the media is that it's very excessive for about a week, and then the news of their death, what happened, just sort of drops off, and we don't hear about it anymore. This is concerning because Philip Seymour Hoffman's death, probably linked to heroin use, is not uncommon in the sphere of reality when people are not celebrities. It's amazing, but, you know, normal people abuse heroin too, and their deaths aren't portrayed in the media. They're not really reported as excessively as Philip Seymour Hoffman's was. Just as a little sample case study, in New York from 2010 to 2012, heroin deaths went up 84%. So that went from 3.1 to 5.2 deaths per 10,000 people, and that was 382 deaths altogether just in 2012. So that is, yeah, that's one death per day, more than one death per day. So literally one or more person died of heroin today, which is quite significant considering that that is just in New York. That's shocking. The numbers speak for themselves, and it's also concerning because the media doesn't really portray it as much. It's an issue. It's an increasing issue. It's relevant. in everyone's lives, just hearing those numbers. And Hoffman, I think, realized the power of the media even before his death. When he was filming Charlie Wilson's War, he was talking to the screenwriter Aaron Sorkin, who also had problems abusing heroin, and Hoffman said to him, "If one of us dies of an overdose, probably 10 people who were about to won't." So here, Hoffman is capturing exactly what I'm saying here, that the media has so much power to pressure kids, pressure people to not abuse heroin and say, you know, that guy died. That could have been me. And so the media needs to report on these issues, highlight the risks of heroin use, of just drug abuse in general. And I think that that's lacking. In 2 weeks, nobody's going to be talking about Philip Seymour Hoffman's death anymore, but they could be talking about that kid that died recently of heroin, or a guy who was found in a supermarket with a syringe. I don't know, just if all the deaths were reported, if people heard about it more frequently, less people would abuse it, less people would die, and it would be, there wouldn't be as much of a demand, and it would be taken off the streets. So keeping that in mind, I think that Hoffman's death spurs on a lot of questions about what is happening in the heroin sphere. There is increased production in Mexico that could be related to the increase of abuse. It's just, it's pretty concerning that it hasn't really been reported on, and I think that the celebrity versus ordinary person complex is definitely relevant here and is something to consider when thinking about these types of issues. That is all I have to say for now. Thank you, and
we're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electropop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, Brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds big, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and
you know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
One campus, one station, over 40 live broadcasts. Tune in every weekend as CITR provides live coverage of UBC varsity sports. With over 40 live internet and radio broadcasts in men's and women's hockey, basketball, and volleyball, CITR is your voice for Thunderbird athletics.
Our next broadcast will be this Friday, February 7th at 7 p.m. as the UBC men's hockey team takes on the University of Saskatchewan Huskies. Will Saskatchewan pull off the victory, or will the Thunderbirds leave the Huskies prairie dogging? Tune in to CITR 101.9 FM this Friday at 7 to find out. It's a UBC Battle Royale on Saturday, as CITR.ca will be broadcasting a UBC versus UBCO men's and women's basketball doubleheader. One school, two teams, who do you cheer for? The games start at 5 p.m. live on CITR.ca, followed by the men's game at 7.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Christine.
I'm Jasmine Gaddy.
And I'm Konstantin Perdanovich. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver or online at CITR.ca. Thank you for being with us.
For our final segment on the show, we have UBC Professor Chris Erickson speaking with Nina Kirgia about how the recent AMS election and the use of joke candidates, examining how this affects student politics.
The moment they feel like they don't make it, they can't make a difference. And I think that with student elections and student politics, because you're dealing with this fairly small space, I think you can make a difference. And I think people can learn that very first hand, that they really can make a difference by participating in things like
this. Yeah, it's interesting. There's a 20% voter turnout for these AMS elections.
That's pretty sad.
So in that context, joke candidates.
Yes.
Like, what role do they have, and what difference do they make?
Yeah.
Those.
I think that what a joke candidate can do is a couple of things. One, I think in a very clear and obvious way, it highlights the fact that there really often isn't that much difference between candidate A and candidate B. And so by coming up with some totally off the wall platform, it's a reminder of how close those candidates can sometimes be.
Yeah.
The serious candidates, right, can sometimes be. And now, part of that's built into the system. You know, you're expected to do a certain job, so obviously you're going to have candidates that are pretty close to each other. Mm-hmm. So I think the joke candidate does highlight the lack of difference. I think it also highlights, and I think it speaks to, the fact that a lot of people don't feel at all represented by the current systems that we have. And certainly not by the people that are running for those offices. And so the joke candidate, in a way, is a protest vote, but might... In the Oxford student elections recently, there was a guy that was elected on the platform that you should vote for him because he wears flip-flops.
He won?
He won, yeah. One of the joke candidates won. Maybe that's something that resonates with more people. And so they see that and say, hey, I wear flip-flops too. Why not?
But does it become sort of, how do I say it, a huge thing of the masses when someone says something like, I wear flip-flops? It's kind of like watching a TV show because the people on it are good-looking. Mm-hmm. Does it take away from the focus, or what you were just saying, give people more focus?
Well, this is the thing. What is the focus? It depends on who defines the focus, right?
True.
If the focus is a government that represents you, maybe the guy in the flip-flops is better than the guy in the three-piece suit. Maybe he is. Maybe he gets what you're doing more than somebody else does. It seems to me that if you want somebody in government, you want somebody... We've kind of gotten away from this. You don't necessarily need the super professional guy in government, necessarily. It's nice to have somebody that's good at what they do. But at the same time, you want a guy that you can trust.
Yeah.
Or a person in general that you could trust. Somebody that you would sit down with and, I don't know, have a beer with or whatever.
Because they're representing you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the way that our elections have gone... It's your choice is, would you like a candidate who is a representative of the ultra-rich, or would you like a candidate who is a representative of the ultra-rich? Yeah. You choose.
Yeah.
And people are like, who cares?
Yeah.
And I think that's where sort of the joke candidate comes in. People are very disaffected by the whole system as it stands. They don't see it doing much for them because, well, in a lot of cases, it's not doing much for them. They don't see... the whole idea of it being a representative of their interests, It's not doing that very well. And so why care about it? And the joke candidate can potentially spark that interest. But it's that point of contact and resonance.
Yeah.
That's what a representative is supposed to do. And in a way, the joke candidate, well, you can almost see this, joke news works like this sometimes. You know, the Daily Report or the Colbert Show, sometimes your news is better on those shows than it is on regular serious news shows, right? There's a concept that Derrida uses, and it's serious play. And interestingly enough, I think it's a concept that Plato uses in The Republic as well. You know, the idea that anything that you want, you know, any lesson that you want to stay in the soul, you don't keep it through compulsory education. You have to learn it through play. And perhaps we need to be a bit more playful with our politics. Democracy doesn't work when you have really only four iterations of the same choice. You know, that's not really what it's all about. It's about a diversity of options. It's about having a range of voices that need to be heard, right? And when you have, you know, your serious candidates that are all essentially speaking in the same voice, that's fine if you want to simply perform a bureaucratic role. But if you want to take a leadership role, if you want to take a role of creativity, of coming up with some new solution to an old problem, then I think you need to be much more playful than that. I think you will need to do so. And I think when we start seeing that, then perhaps we'll start caring a bit more.
Yeah.
We're also, as a society, drastically disempowered. We're encouraged to think that we can't make a difference. And that needs to change too, because we're the only people that ever have made a difference. This is the thing, is that the serious candidates are often running to fill a position that does things that nobody cares about, in a way that nobody cares about. And so, again, the joke candidate, by highlighting that, there's a tremendous irony in the joke candidate, in that they can revitalize the very process that they're trying to be critical of.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it. Like, that's the beauty of the joke candidate, is they can revitalize a moribund process. I think the system works exactly as it's designed to work, and it's benefiting exactly the people that it was designed to benefit. It's just that distinction, the veneer of it benefits everybody, is getting thinner and thinner and thinner all the time. And I think what it calls for is simply a revitalization of the process. I don't think it calls for a revolution. I don't think it necessarily calls for an overthrow of everything. It doesn't. What I think it calls for is a rethinking of the process and a revitalization of the process.
Yeah. Looking outside the box
a little bit. Yeah, a revitalization of the process of deliberative democracy. Without the joke candidate, you wouldn't be having the debates about what's the proper role for a candidate.
True.
You know, and that's exactly the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about.
Yeah, so in the end, joke candidate, good or bad, I would say from this conversation, good.
Yeah, if you were to evaluate it good or bad, I personally would say they're a welcome breath of fresh air. You know, the issue, the troubling side of that is that I don't know if the joke candidate is welcome to run on anything and everything and whatever, the question then becomes, how do you avoid radicalism in politics? And we're seeing a rise of that too. So I think I think the joke candidate and the radical candidate might, in a way, be kind of doing the same sorts of things.
Yeah.
And when you see, like in Europe, the rise of radical right parties, some of them like outright fascist, and that's frightening.
And they're being elected.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
In France, I know that huge demonstrations for anti-gay marriage and. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, and they're exactly, and they are being elected,
mm-hmm.
And so I think that how do you counter the extremism when your centrist candidates are all so interchangeable that you don't care about them? Then all of a sudden, the extreme candidate might look more appealing, and I think that could pose a problem. I don't think it's a simple solution,
yeah.
Right?
It can be dangerous. It can be good, but it can be dangerous.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it can be dangerous. So, you know, I don't think that we're running into the things like that with campus politics, right? I don't think we're necessarily going to see an authoritarian campus
politics. But like politics, you said, as a microcosm, it really does speak to the greater world out there than UBC.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. But this is the beauty of this, of politics. There's no simple, clear answer, because if there was, we'd be doing it already. Yeah. I mean, we're not dumb. You know, as students of politics, we're not dumb. We would be able to figure it out if there was a solid answer. If there was that's just it. But there isn't.
There's too many of us.
But that's tiring. Like, it gets tiring after a while. And so it's easy to fall back on the candidate that says, oh, no, this is exactly what we need to do. I'll give you the answer. It's easy to fall back on that. It's much more demanding to step up and say, no, that's not the way that I want this to go, and there is no easy answer. Let's really listen.
That's our program for today, the 7th of February. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Jasmine Gaddy.
And I'm Christine.
And I'm Konstantin Prudanovich. Today's show is produced by Talita Kali. For an entire news team, from our entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.